How Can We Live with Sinners? The ninth talk in a series titled Biblical Christianity 101 was presented by David Crabtree on November 21, 2000, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
The topic tonight is how can we live with sinners or something like that? I suspect that everyone has recognized by now that it can be difficult to get along with other people. Every time I go to a large city like New York or Los Angeles or someplace, I never cease to be amazed at how rude and obnoxious people can be. And I often wonder, why would someone choose to live in a place like this with so many rude and obnoxious people? However, big cities do not have a monopoly on rude and obnoxious people. They have been spread out over the landscape, and one can even find an occasional rude or obnoxious person here in Eugene, and occasionally in Springfield. It's not just the few rude and obnoxious people with whom it is difficult to get along, but in the workplace, there are almost always conflicts between people. On campus, there are almost always tensions between people. In living situations like here at the house, there are always tensions between people. Even those people who are our friends, people we have selected because we like them, inevitably, at some time or another, there will be tensions that arise in that relationship. And even in families where we have what ought to be and oftentimes are the most enduring of relationships, there are tensions. So every place we turn, there are people that are difficult to get along with, and there are problems that have to be worked out. As a result, I suspect that everyone has at one time or another had the feeling that I wish I could just go to Siberia where there is no one, and there's a reason for that. But the fact is, we can't live without people. When it comes right down to it, we need people. We need the relationships. We all have a bit of herd instinct in us. We want to be with other people. We are attracted to being with other people. It is interesting to me, having read several accounts of people being in prison camps, that to a man, the most difficult thing that can be in a prison camp is being put in isolation. Being put in isolation, people go crazy. It is unendurable. They would rather be with other people in miserable conditions than to be locked up in a room by themselves. We just do not operate well in isolation from one another. So we are in this predicament where people are hard to live with, but we can't live without them. So we're stuck. We're in this difficult situation. So we live our lives in this tension. And it seems to me, my observation would be, that our deepest and most constant anguish in life is concerning our relationship with other people. The problems that we dwell on, that really eat up our emotional time, it's not the weather, it's not anything else. It's our relationships with other people. So furthermore, it's in relationships with other people that life is, on the one hand, the most painful, but on the other hand, the most rewarding. That both things are true. That's where we find our most enduring and satisfying times. So this is an issue that is worthy of attention. That is, how is it that we can learn to live with sinners? Now, I have conveniently come up with two principles that I think we need to take very, very seriously in this regard. And I have for each of these principles three characteristics that I think are implications of these principles. So I anticipate talking for another 30 minutes or so, and then open up for questions, for either questions about what I have said or any other questions that this generates. The two principles, it seems to me, that are paramount in understanding how it is that we live with other human beings is, first of all, that not only are they sinners, but we are sinners. That's the first one, that we ourselves are sinners. And the second one is that we have been commanded by God to love our neighbor. Okay. Everyone who's been to Sunday school knows that we are all sinners. That is a tenet of Christian theology in most denominations. But we need to understand, when I say that we are sinners, we need to understand that not just in the theoretical sense, but that in fact we are sinners. Deep down in our souls, we are sinners. And that is a concept that it takes a lifetime to learn. As we go on in life, we come to realize more and more the depth of that sin that is within us. And it takes years and years to excavate down to get to that, to where we really understand that, if we come to understand it in this life. What do I mean by sin? What I'm talking about is a deep-seated rebellion against God. It is very vexing to us as human beings to have someone else presume to tell us what to do, have someone else to presume to know what is in our best interest better than we do. And so it is the nature of the rebellion in us that wants to say, I would rather do it myself. I am the one who will call the shots. So ultimately, sin is distrust of God. It's distrust of God's goodness. I'm better off running my life than having God call the shots and tell me what is right and what is wrong. That means, if that's the direction that I'm going, that I'm looking out for myself, then I have to take it all upon myself to look out for my interests. It is a full-time job then for me to look out for my own interests, having taken that responsibility on myself in the first place. That means I have to be on guard with respect to everybody else that I run into for fear that they might somehow keep me from pursuing my interests, keep me from some good. So I have to constantly be on the lookout to see where someone might be encroaching on my good, keeping me from getting what I want in life and what I think I need in life. And I'm not the only one doing that. Everyone else is doing that as well, which means that it's war out there. That's what characterizes human society, is a kind of warfare where everyone is looking out for their own interests because no one else is going to look out for their interests. So it is a dog-eat-dog kind of situation. I won't mention Florida. So I'm always looking out for my interests. I'm always grabbing for what's mine for fear that someone else will get it before I do. I'm always on the defensive. I'm always justified. I'm constantly maneuvering to make sure that I am, at least in my eyes, in the right. As a consequence, the more vigorously then I try to protect my self-interests, the more I am keeping other people at arm's length. I am stiff-arming everyone that I come into contact with for fear that they will encroach upon my space and somehow keep me from getting all that I'm supposed to get and all that is good. As a result, there is a sense in which true closeness between sinners is impossible. Okay, sin, furthermore, it affects our self-perception. It affects the way that we see ourselves. We do not see ourselves the way we really are. None of us do. Think about it. As you look at other people, do you ever see flaws or faults in other people? My suspicion is occasionally. On rare occasions, you might pick up something, a hint of something in someone else. Actually, it happens rather often. In fact, it probably happens daily with every individual that you meet. Their flaws are quite apparent. Now, answer this very honestly. You don't have to answer out loud. You can keep it quiet. But at the end of the day, how many times do you look back at the day and say, I did something wrong? I would guess that's rare. If we're honest with ourselves, I would guess that's rare. Is that likely that we've done nothing wrong? Well, yes, if I'm perfect and everyone else is a sinner. But in reality, it's much more likely, obviously, that I'm deceiving myself. And that in fact, I am just as flawed, at least as flawed as the people that are around me. If that's true, that means that we are inveterate liars to ourselves. And I think that that is the case if you are like me. We are experts at constantly looking at situations in such a way that what we do is always justified and right. Our mind will do whatever is necessary to interpret a situation such that I am doing the good and right thing. I mean, even a murderer on death row has a justification for what he did. It's because he's poor or what. I mean, there are any number of reasons that they might marshal up. But we all want to justify our actions to ourselves. We all want to feel like we have done the right thing, we have acted properly, and our minds are very good at coming up with ways to construe the situation such that we are indeed justified in our eyes. So we are constantly self-justifying. We do it so much, so well, that we are oblivious to that fact. Furthermore, we are super sensitive to the wrongdoings of others. We are very quick to take offense and see ill will in what other people are doing. So we are always justified, and our tendency is to always see ill will in other people, even though we are oblivious to the wrongs that we do to other people. If that's the way we see the world, then it only makes sense that in our relationships they will all be tainted with self-righteousness and condescension. Because we are always right in our eyes, and they are flawed. Everyone else is flawed. Their flaws are apparent. And oftentimes we have blamed ills on them in addition to their real flaws. The only antidote to this is honesty, brutal honesty. And honesty does not come easily to us. I've mentioned this in other forums, but I will mention it again for those that have not heard me tell this story. Many years ago, I was in Paris working through some difficult times, and I decided to start keeping a diary. And at the beginning of the diary, I wrote that I was going to try to be thoroughly honest in everything that I wrote in the diary. And so days later, as I was writing entries, and I would write at least one entry a day, I'd start writing about a situation, and all of a sudden it would strike me that I was picking my words as I was describing the situation in such a way that it made me look better than was really the case. And I would actually write in my diary, "No, I'm lying. This is what really happened." And I was surprised at how often I had to do that, even though the diary was not to be read by anybody. It was only for my own consumption, and yet being honest was hard work. And I think that we would all find that that is true in our lives. It is very difficult to be honest, and yet being honest with ourselves is the first step towards seeing things rightly and some of the necessary changes that follow from that. On a related to this, I suppose, many years ago, Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote a book, a short story called Live Not by Lies. And the point to his short story was, if people would just tell the truth, it would bring down the whole Soviet Union, because the whole structure was built on lies. I mean, it's hard to appreciate the extent to which that was true in the Soviet Union. It was so blatant. They had the five-year plans. I'm sure you're aware of the five-year plans. The quotas of how many shoes had to be produced by this plant in the next 5 years. It was broken down year by year, how many shoes each week had to come out of this plant, how many books had to be printed, how many everything. Well, everybody who worked in a factory, when it came to the end of the week and you had to fill out how many you had produced, you knew that you couldn't put down the number of things produced because it was way under your quota. And you would get in trouble, your boss would get in trouble, everybody would get in trouble. So what do? You lie. And you don't put down the number that you're supposed to produce, because that's not enough. You have to over-fulfill the plan. So you put the number you're supposed to produce plus 10%. And everybody, everywhere, did that every week. Well, the problem with that is if everybody's lying, everybody knows that the whole thing is a lie. All you have to do is have people stop lying, and the whole facade just becomes ludicrous. And Solzhenitsyn was arguing, if everyone tells the truth, the whole thing comes down. Similarly, if you tell the truth about yourself to yourself, your whole facade comes down. And you see yourself clearly for the first time. Okay, so that we are sinners, it affects the way that we relate to others, and it affects the way that we think about ourselves. But if we acknowledge that we are sinners, that we are rebels against God, there are implications then of what that will do to the way that we relate to others. And there are three qualities that it seems to me that will come to the fore if we fully recognize that we too are flawed human beings, that we are rebels against God. The first is forgiveness. We will have a forgiving spirit. Since we realize the extent to which God has been merciful on us and forgiven us for our sins, and to the extent that we understand the depth of the sin that's within us, and therefore the amount of forgiveness that God has freely granted to us, we will naturally then extend that forgiveness to others. As they wrong us, we can forgive them in the same spirit in which God has forgiven us. We can even forgive those who intend to do harm to us. That's what's phenomenal. I suppose it's not too amazing that we should be able to forgive those who harm us and are repentant. But what's amazing is that we can forgive those who intend to do us harm. The story of Joseph is amazing in that respect. Joseph was taken captive by his brothers, who intended to put him to death initially. But they decided, rather than putting him to death, that they would sell him into slavery. He was taken by slave traders to Egypt, where he was sold as a slave to an Egyptian official. Then, as a slave in that household, he was falsely accused of wrongdoing, and he was put into prison, where he stayed for a number of years. And so it was from the time that he was 17 or even younger than that until he was about 30 that he was a slave. But then he worked his way up. He was looked upon with favor by the Egyptian pharaoh and ended up becoming the second most powerful man in all of Egypt. And it was when he was in that position that his brothers came down to Egypt seeking grain during a time of famine. And in that encounter, after being reunited with his brothers, when his father had died, his brothers were afraid, now he's going to take vengeance on us. And Joseph's response was, why do they think so ill of me? I don't hold anything against them. And the statement that he makes is, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. The wonderful thing about that is Joseph's understanding that ultimately things are in God's control. And anyone who does evil to me, even if they intend that evil to me, it cannot come to pass unless God allows it to. And if God allows it to come to pass, then it's all part of what he's doing, and ultimately it will be for my good. Just as what happened to Joseph was painful, but ultimately it saved both him and his family. Had that not happened, they probably all would have died in the famine. So there's a sense in which I am invulnerable. As a believer, I am invulnerable. I can be kicked around. I can be shot. I can lose my life. I can even be driven crazy. But the thing that's really important, the condition of my soul, is in safe hands. And they can't touch it. So I am ultimately safe. So I am very free to be forgiving. Secondly, I can be patient. If we are honest with ourselves, we realize how difficult substantial change is to come by. That is to say, even in those situations where we realize that we need to change and we want to change, that rarely happens overnight. It's always a long, slow process. I mean, that's one of the things that that marriage has been very helpful to me in learning. Because in marriage, for the first time, it's a relationship that's really important to me. Before I was married, relationships were always disposable, to one degree or another. It's not that I didn't care about relationships, but none of them were really, really important to me. But in marriage, it's a different story. That really is important to me. So then the question is, if there are changes that I need to make, I want to make them. But when you're in that situation and you try to make those changes, you realize how difficult it is. There's some things about you that even if you want to change them, it's very, very difficult. So if we realize how difficult substantial change is in our life, surely the same case, it's the same case with others. And we need to be patient. And we need to recognize that patience, because patience has been granted to us by God. I mean, if we look at our own lives, God works on us a little bit at a time. I mean, can you imagine if God were to bring a list of everything that's wrong with you and confront you with it at one shot? It would be devastating. I mean, none of us could bear it. So that's not the way he does it. He's got this list, and there's an order of priority. It is a different order of priority for every person. Every person has a customized curriculum. And God takes you through your customized curriculum as your life progresses. And it hits on different issues at different times. And we need to allow God to work through his curriculum in the lives of other people. And have the patience to allow God to do that. Oftentimes, we want other people to change because their flaws are aggravating to me. We don't care how they get fixed. We just want them so they don't aggravate us. God's project is different. He's not trying to just remove the problem and make us comfortable. He wants to really deal with the problem, turn the problem around. He wants radical transformation, not a superficial dealing with the problem. That takes time. And we need to have the patience to allow God to do that. So our goal should not be peace now at all costs, but rather real healing, and allow God to bring that about in his own time. The third trait is tolerance. We have to realize we are all aggravating in many ways to other people. And therefore, we need to cut other people slack. Some of what is aggravating about us, there's nothing morally wrong about it whatsoever. You're too short, or you're too tall, or you're too something, or too something else. Or I had, when I was in college, I had a roommate who was, I went to a new college and didn't know anybody there, and got a roommate at random. And unfortunately, I snore. And this fellow, my roommate, every morning he was more and more angry with me. And within about 3 weeks, he moved out, just couldn't stand the sight of me. Well, that's all understandable. It's all very understandable. I am sorry, and I was sorry, but the fact is, I couldn't do anything about it. There are things about us that are true. I mean, they're just part of us. They are aggravating to other people, and we need to be tolerant of other people. That's just the way it is. We are all creatures and bound by our creatureliness. And with creatureliness comes a certain amount of awkwardness. Things that can be aggravating. But even things in other people that are morally wrong, there's a sense in which we need to be tolerant. That is, we need to be patient with respect to those things. By tolerant, I don't mean condone the wrongness, but what I mean is don't sever the relationship because someone else has moral flaws. Those are things that with time, God will work on and transform and change. And we may play a role in bringing about that transformation. And if that's true, that's wonderful. But if we decide that we need to cut off ties with everyone who is morally flawed, we will have to go to Siberia because we all have that problem. Okay, so those are the things that are related to principle one, that we are sinners ourselves. The second principle, that we need to love our neighbor. It is our obligation in the eyes of God. He has given us the commandment to love those that cross our paths. That means both believers and non-believers, that we need to act lovingly towards them. That is, we need to be concerned about their own best interests. But I think we bear the prior responsibility, the greater responsibility to other believers, in that they are more closely related to us ultimately. Now, the fact that if we have come to the place where we are repentant of our rebelliousness, then we realize that God does indeed have our best interests in mind. And if we can trust Him to look out for our best interests, that's very freeing. Because I don't have to be on the lookout now to make sure that nobody is getting any of my good, swiping it from me. I don't have to worry about that. That's extremely freeing in relationships. That means I no longer have to stiff arm everybody. I can relax. God will take care of me. And I can focus on their interests, not mine. Because God's focusing on mine. That frees us up to exhibit three other characteristics. The first one is thoughtfulness, just being considerate towards others. Taking seriously the fact that everything I do has an impact on everyone else. That's something that is becoming more clear in modern times. In modern times, at least at the international level, it's becoming obvious that the boundaries between countries no longer make all that much difference. Economic transactions are taking place across borders. Pollution goes across borders. We are all tied together, whether we like it or not. In any society, we're all tied together. And everything we do has an impact on everybody else. It's inescapable. I have thought about this a little bit with respect to teaching manners. My mother did not do a great job of teaching us manners through no fault of her own. We were not very, very avid students of the art of where you put your plates and where you put your knives and forks and stuff. My third oldest brother got married in Pensacola, Florida, to a woman who had been a debutante. It scared my mother to death because she was taking her vandals down to this high class wedding. So, and we drove in a car. So the whole trip down there, every time we stopped at a restaurant, my mother would give us another crash course in manners. It was quite amusing. And we have not really taught our children manners, probably as a consequence. But I have thought about that a little bit. There's a sense in which that's a shame. For all of the bad press that Emily Post and manners get, there's a sense in which it provides a valuable service. If you're paying attention to manners, what you are doing is you are learning that everything I do has an impact on others. You are learning to be considerate. Now, I think I'm not sure that one has to learn Emily Post in order to learn that. But that lesson of always taking into account the impact of my actions on other people is a good habit to develop, a thoughtfulness, a sense of consideration for others. And something I might say that in modern times has deteriorated, that we as a society don't really take that seriously. So thoughtfulness is the first characteristic that follows from loving our neighbors. The second one I call constructiveness, but only because I couldn't come up with a better noun. What I mean by that is, how can I act in such a way that I have a positive, constructive influence in the lives of those people around me? How can I be helpful? How can I be supportive? How can I be encouraging? How can I be physically helping? When and where do I need to admonish someone else? That different situations call for different responses on my part, and it takes a great deal of wisdom on my part to determine what is the most appropriate and helpful thing that I can do with respect to this person at this time. And that will vary widely. Sometimes it's rushing to their aid. Another time it's leaving them alone completely. Another time it is chewing them out. And another time it is allowing them to cry on your shoulder. It takes wisdom to know which of those to do when, but all of those can be things that would be very helpful and constructive in the life of another person. And that is the criteria by which I need to decide which of those things that I will do. It's not the question of what will make things better for me. It's not the question of what will make this problem disappear immediately. But rather, in the long run, what is in the best interests of the other person. And the third trait is respect. And I think this is an increasingly important one. We need to realize that we cannot live another person's life. For me, there's a line someplace beyond which I ought not cross. That there's my life here and there's the other person's life here. I can help them. I can be of assistance. I can do all kinds of things to be supportive and encouraging, but I can't live their life. That ultimately what they do is between them and God, and they need to work that out. We can help them to try to work that out, but they need to work that out. I cannot make them act in obedience to God. And even if I could, I shouldn't. That is coercion or manipulation. And that's not loving. Some means simply are not proper. They disregard a proper kind of respect and separation that we need to make between us and other people. To violate that separation is to treat them like a puppet or a pet rather than another human being, an equal. Okay, what is our goal then when it comes to relating to other people? What do we want to achieve? What we want to achieve is we want to become mature believers who act in love towards everyone around us. We want to encourage health, spiritual health in the people around us. We want to facilitate real peace and harmony, not a facade of peace and harmony, but real peace and harmony. And we want to become capable of dealing with all kinds of people. We want to be very flexible. There is an illustration that Mortimer Adler uses in his book, How to Read a Book, that I am going to steal and appropriate for my own purposes. And his illustration is of a pitcher and a catcher. And the pitcher throws all kinds of pitches, a fastball, a curve, a knuckleball, slider, spitball, knuckleball, legal, illegal balls. The catcher's job is to catch those balls. A bad catcher can only catch one kind of pitch. A good catcher is able to catch whatever is thrown at him. He's got the flexibility to be able to adjust to anything that comes at him. Similarly, we as human beings need to develop that kind of flexibility in how to relate to other people, because there are lots of different kinds of people, you may have noticed. There are about as many different kinds of people as there are people. We need to become very flexible. We need to be able to adjust to whoever it is that we're dealing with in whatever situation we're dealing with them. That's the ideal. That's what we're aiming towards. That is a wonderful skill, and it is a skill that is very rare. And it is a skill that is very healing in any kind of society. If you've got people like that, it's like stilling, putting oil on rough waters. I often think of the analogy of, I like the phrase that someone leaves a wake of destruction. It's not that I like wakes of destruction, but the image is so, it pictures it so well. You can just see this boat passing through, leaving behind this wake that has a continuing effect. And if it's a wake of destruction, then it is a continuing effect of destruction and disorder that's been brought about by this boat that just whizzed through. For the most part, that's what people leave behind them, a wake of destruction. But there's another kind of wake that can be left. A boat can also whiz through and leave a different kind of wake, a wake that brings about healing and that facilitates healing and wholeness and peace and harmony. That we can be the kind of people in our relationships with others that facilitate and encourage the peace and harmony and the growth and healing that ought to happen. And obviously, we want to be striving to become that latter kind of person. Now, having said that, I need to quickly jump in and point out that even a perfectly righteous man is, in one sense, not going to leave a wake of perfect peace and harmony behind him. Jesus, for instance, there is a sense in which Jesus brought discord. So our ultimate goal is not that everything is wonderful behind us. Our goal is to live in obedience to God. We will let the wake take care of itself. But if we strive to be obedient to God, to a large extent, what will be behind us is that wake of peace and harmony and wholeness. Really, our goal is to learn to live righteously before our God, live in obedience to His commandments. And in our relationships with one another, That's a wonderful school to learn the kinds of lessons that you need to learn in order to become a godly person. You learn an enormous amount about yourself. It's in those relationships that you come to understand the nature, the true depth of the sin that's within you, how difficult it is to change some of the things about you. But you also learn a great deal about God, His grace, His patience, His mercy, the depth of all of those things. So it's a lot of work learning how to get along with other people in a way that's constructive. But it's worth the work. And part of what it's producing is it's helping to bring about the perfection of our souls. And clearly that's worth the effort. Okay. That's all that I had prepared to say. And so I would be more than happy to entertain any comments or questions.
Yeah. Are sinners capable of honesty?
What kind of honesty?
The honesty that's required.
I think that the answer to that would be no. If we're talking about, can a sinner see himself for what he really is? I think the answer to that is no. Because it is the nature of us as human beings. God built into us His... We are moral beings. I think it is very interesting that across the world, every time, every place, people are interested in justice and fairness. That's because God made us to be moral beings. And because of that God-given concern about fairness and justice, we could not live with ourselves if we are not fair and just. So I'm convinced that a sinner, the closer they get to seeing who they really are, at some point they're always going to shy away and say, no, I can't really stare into that. I can't face into that. That can't be. And settle for an image of themselves that is justified, that somehow is justified. I think that's the nature of the evil within us. We just can't. If we really look at ourselves for what we are, honestly stare ourselves in the face, then we have to face into the fact that that's unjustifiable. And what do we do about that? And there's only way that that's justifiable, and that's through the grace of God. So we are either going to turn away or we turn to God. I don't think there's any other option.
So then that... Is it like a revelation then? Is it some type that, like honesty then, or the ability to...
see ourselves?
Yeah. Is that a gift?
That's an act of God. That's a grace.
An initial gift.
That's an act of God.
So do you think when we go to heaven that we'll be able to look back and realize what we're doing?
I think so. Mm-hmm. And I think we will be, on the one hand, horrified, and on the other hand, we will be more grateful than we ever were on this earth.
Think about the forgiveness and how we can, as we look at ourselves, or I was basically thinking about that story of Joseph that you were telling. Mm-hmm. But even Joseph, I don't know, maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, but he kind of put his brothers to a test, too. I mean, he didn't come with open-hearted forgiveness. He didn't let them know who he was right away, for one. He didn't embrace them right away. He didn't, you know, he put them through that test and made them fearful.
Right.
And partly, I mean, I'm wondering, just human nature, he wanted to see if they had changed and how that response would have changed him or not. Mm-hmm. I mean...
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting question to ask in reading that account. At what point does Joseph forgive his brothers? It's not clear what he's doing with the testing there. Is he kind of getting back at them? Or has he indeed forgiven them? And does he see the value in them coming to face into what they've done?
Yeah.
in a way that they haven't before. I don't know the answer to that. But clearly, by the time his father dies, he has resolved the issue. At that time, he has forgiven them. And I think he has forgiven them fully. He means what he says at the end of Genesis. And that's very human. That when we understand how God has forgiven us, it is difficult oftentimes to extend that to others. And sometimes it takes us a period of time to cope with our feelings and get everything in line with what we know to be true. That can be very difficult and take a while. Question?
Can you describe a little bit more what it means or what it looks like to respect those sinners? What do you mean by that?
Well, let me use an example. Soccer. I have been struck by behavior that I have seen on the part of parents on sidelines at soccer matches. In a particular one game that I witnessed, in which the daughter of this man was put in goal. She wasn't a goalie, but she was put in goal, and she allowed the winning goal to be scored on her. She just blew it and didn't get the ball, and she should have got it. Was a fairly easy save, and she didn't make the save. He was furious at her and would not speak to her all the way home from the game. There's something strange about that. And I've thought about that. I've been trying to figure out what's going on there. And there's my best guess is that there's something about my generation that particularly wants to live its life through its children. It's not just soccer, but you see it in academics, you see it other places. They want their child to be really successful. And it's not, certainly in some cases, it's a kind of perverse living their life through their child. And I think what's happening there is it's a lack of respect for their child as a human being, as a person. They want to live their life through the child rather than letting the child have his or her own life, essentially. And I think we can do the same thing with other people, that it is sometimes difficult for us to allow people to live their lives, make their mistakes, and help them cope with that, but still it's their life and it's their mistakes. And we need to develop the wisdom to know, when are we encroaching over that line? When are we invading? And by invading, showing a lack of respect for them. In a sense, stealing part of their life away, trying to take part of their life out of their control. And there's something perverse about that. There's something wrong about that.
Is it fair to say that everyone has respectability because we're made in God's image?
Absolutely. And I think we live in a cultural climate in which we have downplayed the fact that we are all made in the image of God and therefore all have worth. I mean, we live in a time when self-esteem movement is a big deal, and they're trying to figure out, well, how do you instill that self-esteem and trying various techniques to do it. But I think the symptom belies a real problem, and that is we have stolen away from everybody any basis for worth. And the basis for worth is we were made in the image of God. By ignoring that fact, we're able to run roughshod over people. And we're seeing the symptoms of that.
How can we tell when we're doing something with the interest of the other person in mind and not just using that as an excuse to take care of our loneliness?
Honesty's good. Here again, it's a matter of... there are two things. One is, we need to be honest with ourselves. What are we really doing here? And being a little bit introspective. Being willing to examine our motives and what we're doing and why we're doing it. And the other is just wisdom that we gain over time. That as we are introspective in various situations, we come to a better understanding of who we are and how we operate. And we can begin to see the signs, oh, I'm doing that again. But I think it's just a matter of being honest with ourselves, and then over time, God teaching us. Yes?
What's the relationship between loving, actually loving sinners or getting along, you know, that type of thing, and loving God?
One is a corollary of the other. It seems to me that the Ten Commandments, we've got two sets of five. One set, the first five, can be summed up, love the Lord your God with all your heart. And the next set of five can be summed up, love your neighbor as yourself. And they are the two parts of the law. That if we love God, it follows that we will love our neighbor.
And in that sense, that our relationship with your neighbor or sinners would be indicative of your relationship with God. What I'm wondering, I guess, too, like in the concepts you spoke of, is it like if you're having a hard time forgiving somebody, would that relationship show that perhaps you're having like a hard, you're not understanding the depth of God's forgiveness for you, or like, you know,
right.
You might think you're loving God, but if it's not manifest
right.
in
right.
that relationship,
right.
then that's pretty much the depth of
right.
your love.
I think that's true. I think that's true. That particularly in that case, that our ability to forgive is directly dependent on an appreciation for what God has forgiven us of.
And therefore you could use that, like the areas you're struggling with in relationship with others would be like a red flag to what you're struggling with in your relationship with God.
I would have to think about whether... I'm not sure that we can look at our struggles with other people and assume that there is a that our struggle with our relationship with God would be in the same area, if that's what you mean. I'm not sure that relates. In the forgiveness, it does. I'm not sure that if I lack patience with someone else, does that mean that I don't understand the patience that God has given to me? Possibly. I mean, it's possible that one could see that kind of relationship in the two analogous situations. But I'm not sure that would always be the case. I have to think about that. But to the extent that we don't have a desire to love our neighbor, I would say that reflects on our misunderstanding of who God is and what He's up to. Yes? Yes?
Do you think you can better convince me that we are moral beings?
That we are moral beings? I don't know. what I mean by that is that we were made, when it says that we were made in the image of God, I think what that means is that we were made as beings that are capable of reflecting God's moral character. And the reason that I think that it means that exegetically is because the same phrase that's used there when it's talking about God in chapter 1, that is the same phrase that we see used with respect to Seth when Seth is born. And it is not used with respect to anyone else who is born. And the significance of that is, here we have two offspring of Adam and Eve that are talked about in chapter 4, Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel. And Cain shows a great deal of arrogance and rebelliousness with respect to God. And then it charts out his descendants, and it tells a little bit about his descendants, and they are all rebels. Then it says that Adam gave birth to Seth, who was in his likeness and image. And it's the same phrase there that it has in chapter 1. I don't think that means that Seth had the same eye color as Adam. When it says likeness and image, in context, we've got two lines of descent coming from Adam and Eve. One is characterized by rebelliousness against God and arrogance, and the other one is characterized by responsiveness to God. So when it says Seth was in his likeness and image, I think it has to be talking about moral character. So that's exegetically. But I would just appeal to your, to what you see around you. There is a sense of, all over the world, every time and every place, people have a sense of right and wrong. People always have a sense of justice and fairness. I'm confident of it. A very keen sense one. A kind of distorted one at some at places, but it's a very keen one. And why is it that we all want to justify ourselves? Why does it matter that we're right, that we're justified, that we're square with the world, at least in our own eyes? If we weren't moral beings, it shouldn't matter. But the fact that it matters to us, it seems to me, indicates that there's something there. There's something built into us, some moral sensibility that's right there, part of our makeup.
There's a difference between seeing that you have faults and like understanding yourself as a sinner, or do you think that the one just precedes the other?
A difference between having seeing that you have faults and seeing that you're a sinner.
Like seeing that you have faults that are sin, seeing that like you are rebellious against God and could be nothing but rebellious against God.
Is there a relationship between the two?
Is there a difference?
Is there a difference?
Or is one just like on the road towards seeing the other?
There is a difference. And the difference is, there is a difference between two things. And let's see, I'm not sure whether these two things correspond to the two things that you've described. But what we are called to is obedience to God in the sense that we not only are supposed to do what God wants us to do, He wants us to embrace His values as His own, such that if I could get away with doing something that was against God's principles, but could do so with impunity, He wouldn't know anything about it, nobody would know anything about it, I'd be off scot-free, would I do it? And what God wants is that we would indeed embrace those values for ourselves, such that we not only do what He wants us to do, but we love doing what He wants us to do. So it's realizing that we don't love what He loves, that we are determined to decide for ourselves what is good and what is bad, rather than trust His judgment as to what is good and what is bad for me. That's the nature of the rebellion that's in us. One can come to see that one has flaws, it seems to me, without realizing the nature, that kind of rebelliousness that is within us. If we can talk about, for instance, the Pharisees. The Pharisees, I think, would have acknowledged that they had committed sins. But what they didn't realize is there is a deep-seated rebellion within them that was abhorrent to God. So can one come to see that they do things that are wrong? Is that a step towards seeing one's rebelliousness? I think the answer is sometimes it is and sometimes it is not. It depends what they do with that, where they go with that, where they proceed from there. Anything else? Okay, thanks.